when a life is more valuable over another life based on a color of a person's skin. And the last two things I want to add, when we going back to promoting resilience, one of the most traumatic things as it relates to Black and brown people and people who come from different cultures and communities is the use of Ebonics. I encourage teachers in the classroom setting, don't discourage that bilingual student, because that has become a survival language. And when we see people marching and we're not saying things grammatically correct, we are unified in that cultural difference. Also, challenge what is being taught to our children. Identify where your textbooks are written. What history are your children being given? And how can you build on that history so that they can go in the world with a bigger scope than what they possibly came to you with?
Thank you very much. I can't believe it, but we are out of time. I really appreciate all of my guests being here and sharing information on childhood trauma and how we as parents and teachers can help our students and children through these traumatic events that might affect them later. Debbie Kelly is one of our guests. She is a social work professor at Carthage College. Tim Grove is part of the St. A team that has trained 60,000 people in trauma-informed care over the past 12 years. And Dr. Dominique Pritchett is a licensed mental health clinician, consultant, and coach, and the owner and clinical director at Beloved Wellness Center in Kenosha, a private mental health practice. You are listening to WGTD HDFM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of helping children to process traumatic events is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. Thank you for joining us, and please listen again if you want to hear more information.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters. Our topic today is an update on the city of Kenosha from the new city administrator, John Morrissey. John, who assumed his current position this summer, is with us this morning, and we're pre-recording this on Wednesday. Good morning, Mr. Morrissey.
Hi, Len. How are you doing?
Great, great. Thank you for joining us. I know you are a very, very busy guy right now. Now, Mr. Morrissey, if I were to look at your resume for the past 10 months, it would look more like a Generation Z resume than mine or someone your age normally. Tell us a little bit about your career path recently. Let's see. Last December, you were police chief. Then you became director of city inspection, and now you are city administrator. Tell us about that, okay?
So, yeah, it might look like I can't hold down a job, but so technically, though, I retired as the police chief in April of 2016. So I actually had been retired for almost a full 4 years. And then the mayor had contacted me about the Department of City Inspections. They had separated them from community development back to their own department. And the agreement then was that I would come back on a part-time basis to provide some leadership and direction down there. And then the, I would say, very unexpected announcement that Randy Hernandez, the former city administrator, announced he was leaving his position. And when he had applied for that position, I also had applied back a year ago. So I was still on the eligibility list, and the mayor asked me to assume this role as of June 22nd. So, I am now here. I'm also, though, continuing as the director of inspection, so I'm actually holding both titles.
Well, that ought to keep you busy. I guess you just couldn't stand all that lack of stress in retirement, huh?
Sometimes with what's been going on the last month or so, wondering why I came out of retirement. But certainly my whole career in law enforcement, the majority of it has been dedicated to the city and public service. And again, I needed the retirement break, and hopefully I can give a few good years back to the city yet.
Well, you know, that interregnum may be very good for your point of view and your sense of balance as you approach a whole new set of responsibilities from a very, very different angle. What do you think?
I think that you're absolutely correct that my previous city experience certainly plays a huge role in me taking this over, having worked with the majority of the department heads. But the background in law enforcement, especially with what's happened in the last few weeks, I think I've been able to provide the mayor a different point of view, a different vision on why things happen, how they happen, where, you know, the previous administrators wouldn't have had the law enforcement experience. Certainly the chief and the command staff at the PD are doing it, but I'm able to provide a whole different perspective to the mayor. As you probably have noticed, politically, I'll call it, or media-wise, I've stayed out of the media in response to the civil unrest, because that, again, is I'm in the background. I focus most of my day on the operations of the city, which, of course, you know, before was one department, either police or inspections, and now it's all 15 of them. So I really am trying to stay focused on making sure that we provide the services that the city still needs while the politics of this all play out.
Before we get into other issues which are of importance, I wonder if we could talk about the election, which is really important. Election is Tuesday, November 3rd. Ballots are out. I've got my ballots already done here in this household. We're ready to drop them off. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that process? There was a flyer that came with our absent voter ballots that said the drop boxes, and they gave a list of locations, would be available October 6th. And some of us are confused because we know that the drop boxes are out now. We just got a news release from you all on Tuesday. Could you tell us, can we use the drop boxes? You might even mention where they are and how that drop box thing works and how safe it is.
Yeah, so it's a new program this year as far as the drop boxes, the big ones that you've seen. The reason you can use them now is the October 5th date was when we were planning and the shipment, but we were able to get the boxes and we were able to get the cement pads that they're installed on for security beforehand. So they are available. They are located, there are two here at City Hall, and then the Southwest Library, Northside Library, and Uptown Library have boxes, as well as the Transit Center and the Kenosha Water Utility on Green Bay Road. So we've tried to spread those out throughout the city, so individuals don't have to drive down to City Hall or don't have to mail them in. The way they're manufactured, they're secure. We have two people that go to empty them every day, and they have to sign a log to document the ballots that are brought in. And then when those ballots are brought to City Hall, they are re-logged in that you've returned it. We have a little over 17,000 absentee ballots that have been sent out, requested already this year. And as of this morning, we already have 4,474 back. So it is a huge undertaking. So we're actually going to close City Hall on election day. And there'll be 100 plus employees here trying to count those new ballots. Part of the whole new process is we've got the ballot boxes, as you said, but we've got three high speed ballot tabulators. And we're hoping that assists us in counting this. We're anticipating at least 20, if not 25,000 absentee ballots, to get through, and as you probably know, the courts are still deciding when they have to be counted.
That's quite a big project. Will that be by far the biggest absent voter ballot ever in the city of Kenosha, Mr. Morrissey?
We certainly anticipate that. The last presidential ballot had a lot of absentee election, I should say, had a lot of absentee ballots, but we anticipate a lot more this time. And that's twofold. Number one, there is a huge push to get out and vote. And I would recommend to everybody, no matter how you're going to vote, please do get out and vote. That's one right that we should make sure we appreciate and take care of. But the COVID certainly has made other people very nervous to come out. So the COVID is playing a role. So I anticipate this will be by far the largest absentee ballot. And I think we're going to see a huge increase in early voting as well. So we've made a couple changes there. You can vote here at City Hall. from October 20th through November there. And then you can have drive-up voting at the Civil War parking lot, or you can actually vote absentee in person at the Public Museum during that same time frame. So we've certainly tried to give more options and more locations for individuals. So we're spreading it out, and you're not having, you know, 100 people in line here for social distancing and COVID and such.
That's terrific. I'm really impressed with the way you've distributed those drop boxes. And I think that having one at the transportation center is a real stroke of genius. That makes a lot of sense. I wouldn't have thought of that. That's a terrific idea. So I guess I can stop hanging on to these ballots and worrying I'll misplace them. I can just drive out to City Hall or one of those other drop boxes and get them off my hands and get them down to you right away. That's wonderful to know. John, this has been the. Are you a native of Kenosha, by the way?
I am not. I'm a transplant in 1989.
Well, you've had a long experience in Kenosha. I'm a native, but I was away for a while to have a career, and then I've been back for 20 years. We've never been through anything like this in Kenosha, and most cities haven't. So we're under the push of a lot of issues right now, locally, regionally, and nationally. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the recovery of the civil unrest. We'll get into some of the other issues later. There was an article in the Kenosha News Wednesday morning that there was going to be $1 million coming for law enforcement. And the interpretation that was given to the reporter through the interview appeared to be that money was going to go to pay for overtime, money that you already have spent, and that you were going to use it for, and that it was available for equipment. Do you have any intelligence at this point as to how that $1 million will be used here on the ground, or is it too early? And if it is too early, can you clarify what the options would be to use that money for you and the mayor to improve the situation with respect to law enforcement?
Yeah, so as most people know, when the President Trump was in town, he had announced that he was giving $1 million specifically to Kenosha law enforcement, and then $4 million for small business recovery, and $42 million for statewide for public safety. The $1 million is directly impacts the city of Kenosha and Kenosha County. So the split of that money will be 60% to the city and 40% to the county. The city's take has already been allocated. The overtime for the city police was $631,000 during this unrest. So that money will all go towards overtime for the city. The county has chosen to use theirs for a multitude of things, which is overtime and equipment. Some of the other costs that people don't realize when you bring in the federal or the state law enforcement that come from other areas, you know, there's like $30,000 of hotel bills and stuff that were put up, and there's, you know, $10,000, $11,000, $12,000 for food and those kinds of things. So the county can allocate their 40%, $400,000, however they want. But the city is going to put the entire allocation to assist in the budget whole of the overtime.
Wow, that's a lot of money in terms of the extra cost, unanticipated, of course, cost to the city. I actually hadn't thought it would rise to well over $500,000. Is that all for our own local officers then? That doesn't, for the city's part, did I understand you correctly? It's all for our own local officers?
Correct. That is just the city police department overtime. As you probably are aware, most of those officers were either working 16, some were actually working 20 hours a day during the main time of this. So that, again, is just strictly a city of Kenosha number. I know the sheriff's department number is about $400,000 in overtime. And then you have to add in, of course, all the other state agencies that came in to assist and their budgets as well. So it is a tremendous financial burden to the city of this entire civil unrest.
What is the status of your knowledge as of Wednesday of this week when we're making this recording, sir, of additional money that's been talked about, some $4 million or so for business recovery, and whether that was extra money or included in what President Trump earlier mentioned? Do you have any further clarification on that? And if not, when do you think you might?
So I do not. So the president indicated at his roundtable, and I attended there, that there was going to be $4 million for the businesses that had burned up or burned down, I believe was his comment. However, ironically, on the 31st, there was $3.9 million allocated to CABA in CARE funds, which have to be used for COVID-related expenses. So we are trying to clarify whether that $4 million is new money actually coming, or if he was speaking of the 3.9. Either way, I've reached out to Congressman Stile. He has a better contact at the White House than we do, to see if it is an additional $4 million, because if it is, we have not been advised how we need to obtain those funds. But we have also asked, if it's not new money, then we need to reallocate or have the ability to reallocate the $3.9 million that went to CABA. Perhaps it doesn't have to be COVID funds out of the CARE Act. It can be used for the small businesses. So, and then we've also, as you probably know, got the $4 million from the state to help out the small businesses, and that's in a loan thing. They can get up to $50,000 a loan to assist in them. And that's being run through CABA as well.
If you've just tuned in, listener, this is Community Matters. I'm Len Iaquinta, and we're talking with John Morrissey, the new city administrator of the city of Kenosha. Now, John, I suppose you would want to have it all. You don't want to switch COVID into business recovery or steal from that to fund rebuilding of businesses. You want it all, 8, 9, 10, whatever. What can we do to make sure that we get as much as we possibly can? Because a city with a budget of our size, this is a crippling economic blow, isn't it? What can be done, and what could the citizens do to help promote this? Should we be writing to Congressman Stile and to our state senators and tell them to get on the ball for us?
Well, I would certainly suggest that you individually, as citizens, reach out to not only the state representatives, but the federal representatives. So Congressman Stile and both U.S. Senators, Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin. I can tell you that myself and the mayor have spoke to all three of them individuals. We certainly have spoken to the local contingents, whether it's Tip McGuire, Todd Onsted, Samantha Kirkman, or higher up. The mayor has had conversations. Just last Friday, we had a lot of the secretaries from the state of Wisconsin at a meeting. We discussed what funding we believe we need, how it could help to mainly do the uptown. We talked about a lot more than just the businesses that are there. I think there needs to be a revitalization on top of rebuilding. But our biggest concern was that when these businesses are rebuilt up there, that the individuals that are currently there, the business operators, have an opportunity to be back in the new buildings. That was a big point that we wanted to make. So we've met with the department, or Secretary of Administration, Secretary of Revenue, representatives of the Secretary of Transportation. So those meetings, I would say there's probably not a day that goes by that there isn't some kind of communication from administration here, whether it's through me, the mayor, or other individuals, reaching out to see what money we can get. If I was to talk to the president of the United States, I would say, give us $50 million that we can use to rebuild these businesses and to revitalize the neighborhood. So if he's listening to your show on Saturday, that's my ask. Give me $50 million and we'll get things going in the right direction.
Well, I think there's a really important, I appreciate the social justice aspect of restoring the business owners that were in place and not just casting them to the wind and destroying their careers and their business livelihoods. And you've made a distinction between business rebuilding and revitalizing the community. I wonder if you would go into detail. When you talk about revitalizing the community, what do you mean? There are a lot of issues about systemic racism, about the ability of people to get access to services. We have these food deserts now that have gotten worse in Kenosha. It's hard to believe. For a while, we were doing pretty well, and I was optimistic. Now I'm about as pessimistic as I could be about the food desert situation. How can we use money to revitalize the neighborhoods and start to move toward the social justice concerns and the systemic racism and issues of extreme poverty? Because, you know, Kenosha has never had poverty like this since the Great Depression. And there are some real serious problems we have to address. What are some of the things that you and the mayor have in mind, if you wouldn't mind telling us in as specific detail as makes sense at this time?
Yeah, so I think there's been a lot of stuff in the newspaper about a downtown development. And I know the Brindisi apartments and condos has been advertised, but there's a lot more revitalization in the downtown that goes along with that. We are getting, I think, very close to signing a contract or at least having a agreement on paper. And then there's what we call the KIN, the Kenosha Innovation District neighborhood, which is the old Chrysler site. So those negotiations and trying to get individuals into that. So that's actually part of what we talked to the secretaries and everybody else is funding for that, because that ties into the uptown. But specifically in the uptown area, again, we talked about the businesses that were destroyed due to the civil unrest. But I brought up when I was speaking, what we need in that area is we need a grocery store. And what we need in that area is a pharmacy. The closest grocery store, you know, is, I guess if we're looking at real grocery stores, probably 75th and Pershing on the south side, and then you go to the north side. But we need a grocery store in that area to help revitalize the whole area, whether the Chrysler site gets redeveloped or not. The closest pharmacy is 75th and Sheridan. So those are the things that when I talk about revitalizing the uptown area, that's what we need. Again, we're asking that whoever or however those buildings get rebuilt, that the individual businesses that were in them get asked, do you want to come back? Can you bring your business back here? You know, you're going to see a different landscape. It's just simply because the buildings that are burnt are gone. And we don't anticipate some coming back. You know, the Danish Brotherhood, unfortunately, was burned to the ground. I doubt that'll be rebuilt in that location, but something will be built there. So the landscape is going to change, but we just want to make sure that some services are coming back to that area. You know, we continue, some people would rather just talk about the civil unrest totally, but we can't. You know, the city has to go on. We're still providing services. We're still looking at revitalizing that area and other areas. You know, if homes come for sale where we want to eventually maybe put 16th Avenue through, you know, from 60th Street to 63rd, we continue to do all that stuff. So the majority of everything that was in place continues to do that. We just have another complex layer with the civil unrest and COVID and how we get to some of these things. You know, prior to the civil unrest, we would have probably put a couple different things into place, you know, that we were looking at. But again, it's been a financial hardship on the city.
There have been two listening sessions as of the time of this recording where the mayor and other officials have listened to people in neighborhood settings about their feelings after the shooting of Mr. Blake and the civil unrest that followed. What are you getting out of that so far, Mr. Morrissey? And are you seeing any themes that emerge that you're capable of addressing, you and the mayor?
Well, I haven't attended those again. That's the mayor is attending those. I've talked to the mayor and individuals that have been there. There is the basic theme, I think, that you had talked about earlier. There's certainly the relationship between the police and the community. There's the issues of, I guess, what they would call the justice system. They believe that there's inequities at the court levels of who's incarcerated and who's not incarcerated. But there's also a lot of discussion on poverty, as you indicated. There's also a lot of discussion on the educational system and the access to it. So all of those issues are coming up in these listening sessions. I know that, you know, the prior to the civil unrest, this roadmap that the mayor is working on was in place. So it's just been, I guess, pushed to the forefront due to the civil unrest, but trying to work with all of those and the different minority communities was the mayor's priority prior to the civil unrest. So it's a much bigger package than simply, I think, than the police relationship. But that's probably the biggest theme that we hear at these listening sessions.
The mayor has said several times, quote, things need to change, close quote. Would you be able to clarify what some of the thinking is behind that? Or is Mayor Antaramian waiting for these listening sessions? Does he have an inkling of what those things are?
I don't know that I can speak for him on what he wants or means specifically by that. But in general terms, what we are talking about is that we would love to have more foot patrols or community-oriented policing. We're looking at some training dollars in there for this, too. The unfortunate thing is that the city grows by land mass and businesses, and you still have to provide a lot of services to those. So when we add more personnel, whether it's police, fire, public works, the budgets become tighter and tighter and tighter. But I think when he's talking about change, is he's hoping that there can be more talking and more collaboration between everybody instead of this. I believe that not only this city, but most cities are divided politically. You know, I wouldn't even really want to call it a debate last night, but if you watch that, that's just how divided. And I think when the mayor talks about change, he's looking for a city that everybody comes together, and you know, there really is no color in what people see.
I think we're getting a little background noise from something on your desk. I'm not sure what it is. The community policing that you mentioned and training. Perhaps equipment like cameras, chest cameras and other kinds of cameras and so forth, and the retaining of the information those video cameras have. What about the financing of that? Is it really just a money barrier, or are there political barriers or police union barriers and contract barriers that are just equally as important to the money, Mr. Morrissey?
I don't know of any police union barriers to it. I believe that the police association is in favor of cameras. They have been. It's a extreme expense. We just finished the budget today. There's going to be about $780,000 in there to equip the officers with body cams. And then there becomes a annual cost of maintaining those, which is probably about $50,000. And then the storage of data is where the big expense truly comes in. The city's proposal is that we will do that internally, have our own hard drives and stuff. But most areas are going to storing it on the cloud, if you will, and that's millions of dollars. So we literally will have to hire a minimum of two more individuals to manage the videos that are on the body cams and request for those. Right now, if nothing changed, the policy is that the body cam video would be kept for 120 days before it could be written over. So The policy is, though, if you or anybody says, I want to see that, then it now needs to be kept for a minimum of 7 years. And the storage becomes a huge, huge cost. The other issue that I think a lot of individuals have, police have, I have, is who can see these videos, when they can see these videos. A lot of times you have a lot of police calls in hospitals. So if the officers are required to wear this camera and have it on, how much information is getting recorded that is medical or very private, or in schools? Because we have a lot of issues with police in the schools and recording of children, and somebody comes in and they want to see a video from something that happened at one of the high schools. And then there's the privacy in your own home. So if the officers are there and we're there for domestic and this is all recorded. So those are the things. Again, you'll see the ACLU and everybody demanding videos, but then they're demanding that, you know, well, you can't release this and you can't release that. And I have some very big concerns about the privacy, and especially, again, my three main places are hospitals, schools, and your residents. And that's where, you know, the state needs to come in. They've changed a couple of things with the recordings, but you know, when people think they get that, and I'm going to tell you now and ever, just because you have a body cam on, that's not going to be the savior for all. It certainly will help, and I think it's going to help the police more, because there used to be a lot of complaints that would come in, and if it was on video or they didn't realize it, you know, then their story changed. So I think all of the police believe that they're a good idea, that they're in favor of having those. But I am very concerned about certain open records requests with them. And again, the expense is going to be a permanent expense that needs to be budgeted.
I was surprised to hear you say that two additional people had to be hired to manage this. I had this fantastic idea that this was all automated and untouched by human hand, that the stuff gets stored up on the cloud or wherever, and that's that. What kind of people are we talking about? High-priced technical people, or is it more of a clerical position?
Well, I think it's going to be some of both. You need the IT people. So the starting budgeted salary that we're doing is $77,000. So you can put that into whatever category of clerical or high IT. It becomes the reviewing it, the redacting it, understanding how to store it, all that stuff. So it certainly is going to require somebody with some IT experience in how to do this. Now, again, we're budgeting at two people, one next year and one the year after, by the time the system's up and running. But I know a community that's probably 30,000 smaller than us up to the north, and they have four people doing theirs, and their police department is probably half the size of ours. So I'm not sure that two is going to be there. And again, until the laws catch up to what can and can't be and what should or shouldn't be stored is still going to be an issue of how many people. It could end up being a lot more than two.
Taking another topic, Mr. Morrissey, members of the city council got surprised by a 7-page email from a former clerk treasurer, Deborah Salas. She was complaining about the consulting contracts. And I wonder, what's the status of her complaint about the hiring process, the transparency, the implication that we have a government of old white men and no one else need apply?
Well, I guess the status of her complaint is I didn't take it serious in the context of what she wrote it in. I believe she didn't have the information, and it's unfortunate that she felt the need to send that complaint to the council. Because the reality of it is that Karen Argus, the acting city clerk, came to me. She's stressed on top of it, but needed some assistance in filing certain reports and individual work that she didn't have training on. She had worked with the former clerk before, Ms. Gimler, Ms. Salas, and she was looking forward to having him come in for a few hours to assist her in some training until a new clerk could be retired. Again, as you said, the council voted that down, so we're making it through with the individuals we have, but in reference to the recruitment for the clerk, the initial interviews had taken place. Two individuals have scored in the top. Those two individuals have been sent for a job trade assessment of leadership, and they are trying to schedule the interviews for those two individuals within the next week here. My hope is that we will have in front of the Common Council a name and a resume of an individual that me and the mayor have selected to be the next clerk. And I would hope, probably not good for the clerk, that they would actually start on November 2nd, the day before the election. But I would like them here so they could see how the election works, since that will be one of their main focuses. As far as other hiring, we have interviewed for the Director of City Development, which I believe is a huge important position, especially in this time with the rebuilding and revitalization. So those individuals have gone through their basic assessment and leadership, and myself and the mayor have done our interviews, and we have selected a candidate. So we are in the process today, or Human Resources is, and completing a background on that individual. So I'm hoping to have that individual's name in front of the council so they can start on November 2nd as well.
That is an important position, having spent 50 years in fundraising and government contracts and fundraising of all kinds for not-for-profit organizations. I have a real close affinity for that. So I'm happy to hear you found a suitable candidate. That's really, really important. Another important thing is internet access in our community. I don't know about you, but we struggle with internet access out here in Whitecaps all the time, although we have cable and we have fiber optic from AT&T. And now, according to a news release on the 23rd of this month, something called Sci-Fi Networks is going to develop a city-wide fiber optic network that supposedly is going to give us affordable high-speed options. I'm as skeptical as can be about the efficacy of competition really lowering prices. What's the forecast on when this is going to happen, and can we really believe that there's going to be competition and have affordable internet finally here in Kenosha?
Well, I am certainly hoping so. I don't know that anybody could be any more skeptical than I was when we received the initial call from Sci-Fi. We don't want anything from you other than the ability to utilize public right-of-way, and we'll put in this dark fiber throughout the entire city. Quite frankly, it'll be 631 miles of dark fiber that they'll be laying, and we'll be spending over $100 million of our own money, and we will be bringing on ISP providers. And you have to do nothing other than allow us to use the public right of way. So we reached out to a lot of the cities that there are. And again, they have agreed to my terms of providing a financial letter that shows that the $100+ million is allocated in the bank specifically for the city of Kenosha. They're well aware of the potential growth area that the city has under its boundary agreements with the town of Paris, which is another 3,400 acres roughly that'll come into the city. And that's all included in that they will make sure that this dark fiber is there. We've compared prices again in mainly Fullerton, California, where Sci-Fi operates. I wouldn't say there's a significant drop in the cost. So what $60 gets you now versus what $60 should get you then, what you're really going to see is the speed. So you're talking about megabytes now versus gigabytes there. And if there's enough competition, you know, and they would like to have at least two, if not three or four internet service providers, that's where the competition will come in. And the competition will be with Spectrum and AT&T of that. But they will also work with them if they choose to use their fiber as well. So Sci-Fi isn't the internet provider. They are the company that puts in the dark fiber and then works with the companies to work out these contracts. So I think the biggest thing is the infrastructure is going to be put in at no cost to the taxpayers. Nobody has to connect to it. So I'd asked him several times. So if I don't want it into my house, I don't have to have dark fiber coming into my house. But if I want it, it's going to be there. And then I can choose my provider. The biggest benefit we see to this from the revitalization is downtown. Part of, and this is how they selected us, is we want that to be a smart city. So we want the lights. We want, you know, eventually it could get the automated car kind of thing for smart cities. But this brings that ability in there. So that's where we're really looking, you know, and I mean, we could sell it on many other things, and finances are always there. But in Philadelphia, they're using the smart city. So what they're doing is with the high fiber or black dark fiber, high speed internet, is the police will send a drone to hover over whatever the issue is. And those images are brought back onto their computer before they ever get there. So they have a much better idea what they're driving into. So that's the kind of technology that we're eventually looking to go towards.
And for educational purposes, as well as business purposes, high-speed internet, which we desperately need here. The universities and some organizations have internet too, but most of us have half an internet, it seems, most of the time. Is this going to go into the every neighborhood? Will the most low-income neighborhoods in the city be accessing this, have access to this cable? Is this going to be for everyone, John?
It's going to, the way we're told, it's going to cover every street, both sides of it, the entire city of Kenosha. So everybody will have access to it. Now, again, when it comes to the actual provider, I may choose that I just want the 256 megabytes service and I don't need anything else. And you may want the 100 gigabytes because you're a business. So what type of service you get will be up to the individual where it is. But the actual infrastructure of the dark fiber will be available at everybody's home or business if they want it.
Where's the opportunity for the city to make money on this deal? Is there a rake off from the dark fiber? And by dark fiber, listeners, we're talking about having the fiber optics laid but not being lit up, not being actually used at that point. Will the internet service providers provide a fee to the city? Is there any way for the city to make money off of this, or is this just a matter of enhancing the viability of the city and its infrastructure for the future, just like keeping the roads up?
Yeah, so there is no financial incentive to the city in this agreement. It is absolutely that, just the to vital to keep it up. Try and bring in major businesses. Again, the smart city part for us, there is a small fee while they're here for the first year or two doing it of $7,000 a month that will assist in any fees or cost of inspectors to do that, so they're willing to pay that. But at the end of it, there is no fee, no allocations that are coming to the city for any purposes here. Again, we will continue to work with them on trying to provide the services to City Hall and fire stations and other businesses. So we're going to try and reduce those costs, because currently, you know, to have a line from here to fire station one is $500 and some a month we pay just for that, for having that line there. So we're going to try and reduce all those costs, but there's no guarantees on that at all.
That's terrific. Now, I've never been able to ask anyone this question before, but because of your unique background, I get to ask you this. What do you see is going to be the interplay between policing, neighborhood inspections, and the recovery of the city, not only in terms of repairing businesses, but in repairing human lives, John?
So that's probably a million-dollar question. If I had the exact answer to that, we'd all have there. But I do believe that we as a city can do better. There's no doubt about that. So part of that, though, comes down to the citizens actually assisting us and working with the police, working with inspections. When I took over inspections, one of the reasons I came in was you will see people who just have garbage in their front yard, don't cut their grass, they leave stuff. Again, I am very fortunate. I live by Lance. I have two very good neighbors on each side. We all keep our yards up. But what other people do is what drives your property value, whether other people want to move in. So, but that's, you know, community policing. So the police come there. Again, like I said, I'm directly across the street from Lance. So I've got a school there, but we need the police and the kids at that age to understand what it is. But it's a lot more than, I'm not putting this all on the police by any means. It's the community working with them to do this, but it's also enforcement is part of what they do. Enforcement is part of what inspection does. And that's where everybody gets a little excited is, well, you know, we want all this stuff, but we don't want the enforcement part. Well, that really is a part of what you have to do. So